Hildebrand.
Right.
Who lived to be 100 years old and went to the lab every day. But when I was there, he was in his 70s, and he gave all of the freshman chemistry lectures in this huge hall with 500 seats in it. He would give the lectures, and he was a real showman. He put on, impressive demonstrations. But he was also a very exacting teacher, and so his lectures were very, very complete, and covered the whole material, and then you got tested on it. And but the way that I found a number of Nobel laureates that have been involved in teaching, and there is something different about the way they teach, because they have such mastery of the material that there is a kind of way that it flows, and they don't have to think about it. They can embellish it with little things here and there and make it interesting, and focus on the really essential points in a way that less experienced people can't do. And I wouldn't say that every Nobel laureate is a good teacher, but most of the ones that I've had any contact with have been exceptional teachers. And to be exposed to those people and the way they think does have an effect on how you think about science and how you would think about how would I go about doing things. You're just affected by it. You soak it up in an osmotic way almost. And so it was a great privilege and tremendous educational benefit to go to Berkeley, where these people were teaching these courses. And
this was G.M. Lewis.
I unfortunately arrived just after his death, so I never knew G.M. Lewis, but I lived with his book Thermodynamics for a long time. In fact, there's a copy of G.M. Lewis's book at the bottom of the South China Sea somewhere, because of a story that will come out later during my military service.
So who were you? Whose lectures? Who are the names?
Well, I took a course on thermodynamics from Professor William Joke, who was a low temperature chemist who got a Nobel Prize. Not all of these professors had Nobel Prizes, but some of them were really absolutely outstanding in their fields. There was an inorganic chemistry professor named Bray. He was a big name in inorganic chemistry. He had written many books on the subject. And he was a very interesting man because he had piercing blue eyes. He was he was quite old by then, and so he had very little hair, and what he had was gray, and but his eyes were just luminous blue, and he would fix them on you, and you had the feeling when this man looked at you that he could see right through you, whether you knew what he was talking about or not, and so you really you had to really think about what do I know here, and am I trying to slip something past, because it wouldn't get past him. He would really ask you another question. If your question was answer was evasive or sloppy. And so I came in contact with people that really expected you to know what you were doing if you were going to come and talk to them. And there was also an organic chemistry professor who was near the end of his career, but he had a very eminent career, and his lectures were very droll because this man was old enough by then that he didn't take things so seriously anymore, and yet he was a very good teacher. Melvin Calvin was a professor that I enjoyed very much. He hadn't received his Nobel Prize when I took the course from him. He was a much younger man at that time, but he was so organized and presented the material so beautifully that it was just inspiring. He was also very tough. His exams were really hard, but that's where you learn.
Was Glenn Seaborg in?
Seaborg was there, and I did actually have a course with Seaborg, but by that time he was so involved in the atomic bomb work, the projects, that he was rarely there to give the lectures. He turned them over to one of his assistants, who was also a pretty well-known radio chemist. And so I got the course, but I only saw Seaborg in a few lectures.
It was a spectacular array of people at Berkeley.
It was really a powerhouse. Yeah. It was a tremendous place. And so I really enjoyed my time there. And I was there for, I completed 2 years and was starting the third year. At which point those of us who were in college on deferments and reaching the had passed the point where the draft would pick you up were on deferments, and the deferments went on until about 1944, and in 1944 we were told that there was a very high probability that our deferments would not be renewed, and they were scraping the bottom of the barrel, and fortunately they told us if you want to pursue something that would be more, that would take advantage of your education, you should go over to San Francisco and take an examination called the Eddy test. And so they gave us all the information on how to do that, and I went over there and took this test.
Is that Eddy?
This was a Commander Eddy in the Navy who was trying to recruit people for to be radar technicians. And if you passed the Eddy test, then you were sent first to boot camp, then to a kind of a 30-day first step in which they flunked out about half of the people. And then you went to a 3-month training school where you then began to learn the principles of electronics and to do some actual construction of electronic circuitry. And also ongoing courses in the mathematics of electronics, electrical engineering. And from there, you went to a third school, which lasted 6 months, at which time you finished learning about electronics and the mathematics of it, and you had labs in which you would do troubleshooting on real radar sets. And from there, you went out to sea. If you didn't flunk out along the way. And there was a pretty high attrition rate there because they knew they had to have people that would perform well, and so they just kept throwing it at you and see if they could, pick out the ones who could meet all the challenges. So I took the Eddy test, and I passed the Eddy test, and then all that needed to be done was to get through the physical exam. So we went over for that purpose and went through the way the Navy operates. You get in a line, and you just kind of go past, you walk past a series of stations where they either ask you a question or they do something to you or they listen to your heart or whatever. And finally, the last station was the eye examination. So I had to take off my glasses, and the guy said, "Okay, now read the top line of the chart." And I said, "What chart?" As you can imagine, I didn't pass the eye exam. Everything else was fine. So I went. They sent me from there to the assigning station, and There was a guy there who had a couple of stamps. One said Army, the other said Navy on it. He looked over my stuff. He said, well, I see you don't meet the requirements for the Navy, so I guess you'll be in the Army. He picks up the stamp. He had it up here, ready to bring it down on the papers. And I said, wait. It's just one of those impulsive things, you know. I don't want this to happen. Mm-hmm. Wait. And he stopped, and he looked at me, and I said, isn't there something we can do about this? And he says, well, why don't you go back and take the part of the eye exam over again? So I walked back, and there's a nice doctor, probably in his 50s, waiting there. And I said, I didn't pass the eye exam, and it's really important for me to get into the Navy because I want to be in the electronic radar training. He said, okay, well, we'll do it again. Now, this time, walk up toward the chart, and we'll see how close you have to get. So as I'm walking up, I'm squinting, I'm doing everything under the sun to improve the situation, and I apparently did well enough that he finally stamped it passed. I got back, and I got the Navy stamp on there, and I thought, that was a close shave. Because the alternative, you know, was, first of all, not to use your skills in the best way, and secondly, you might very well spend your time in a foxhole somewhere. And I thought, if I'm gonna be on anything, I'd rather be on a ship than a foxhole. So that was a close call.
Was this something that others in your cohort of science and technologically oriented students did to go over and try and get into the radar unit?
The only people who would try it were probably people who were trained, who had partially completed their science training, because it was a tough test.
Yeah.
Yeah. You really had to know quite a lot of what was going to be taught to you later. So I think there may have been other sources. It probably wasn't exclusively, but I think it was most of the people probably came that way. But there may have been the cases where people in the Navy may have sent their own kids mm-hmm. there to try it out, and maybe could even tell them a little bit about what they ought to study first. But I think most of us came from college.
There were some other Berkeley people went across with you.
Yes, and one of the other ones who went with me was my very best friend, who I had met in college. We both appeared as freshmen in 1942, and we both wanted to join a fraternity, and we decided to join the chemistry fraternity, Alpha Chi Sigma. Mm-hmm. And we both got in to the fraternity, and we just clicked. You know, there's sometimes when you meet a person, and it's just like an extension of yourself. You no matter what circumstances you meet under, you carry right on from where you were the last time you were together. And we soon realized that we were a pair like that. We became inseparable. We went to most classes together. We were in a lot of labs together. And at our fraternity, we spent most of our time together. We'd go up there for lunch, and after lunch, we would, if we didn't have a heavy class schedule, we would sometimes go into the recreation room and play ping pong for 3 hours steadily. He was a very good ping pong player, and as a result, in attempting to get good enough to give him competition, I became a very good ping pong player. And we had some absolutely marvelous afternoons.
His name is
William Reynolds, Bill Reynolds.
Are you still in contact?
And we're still in contact. We've been friends since 1942. And I'm sorry to say that I don't know quite how long it is. But sometime last year, he had a heart attack. He He'd been having what he thought was indigestion, and he had not been doing anything about it because it wasn't really disabling him or anything. He was quite an active person, so he didn't think of anything about heart. And finally, however, he got this indigestion that was really bad, and they kept trying to talk him into going into the emergency room, and he said, oh no, it'll be all right. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, he had to call his son to take him to the emergency room. By that time, this heart attack had been going on for too long, and so he has had ongoing problems. He's now at a certain stage of congestive heart failure. So I try to call him pretty regularly, and he's still doing okay. He's in Houston, Texas, where if they're going to get good care on heart ailments, you couldn't be in a better place.
Yeah.
And they were able to do the bypass surgery, and they've got him stabilized. But once you're in congestive heart failure, it's kind of a downhill road. But so far, it doesn't, he hasn't gone beyond to go over the edge yet. Mm-hmm. And so now we're both in our second half of our 70th, our seventh decade, and I'm hoping that he'll hang on a while.
Yeah. Did he have a industrial career, or did he?
Yes, he did. Our careers really were very parallel in many ways, because we both took the Eddie test, we both got into the program. We went to boot camp together. We went to Wright Junior College in Chicago for the 1 month screening period together. You had to ask for where you wanted to go, and then it was by lot, they drew it. We were both selected to go to the Monterey, California, Del Monte training school there. For 3 months, and then we both asked for Treasure Island in San Francisco, and we're both drawn to go there. So we spent the entire year of training together in the same classes, and we got on the same troop ship to go out to the Pacific. We ended up, of course, in the same place then, in Okinawa, for reassignment. And only then did we get separated and get put on different ships. when we got back, we went back to Cal and we finished our horses together. I went on, and he went to Shell Oil Company. Mm-hmm. Made a very good career for himself in the Shell Oil Company and became a very respected advisor to the top management in Shell down in Houston, and retired about the same time I did. But he's stayed in Houston. But we visited each other over the years, and there's another aspect of our lives which is similar, and that is we both took up ice skating, and we spent a great deal of time ice skating together, and that became a very important part of both our lives. Mm-hmm. So,
and he told Shell to use NMR as well.
Yes, and he knows a little bit about NMR, but of course, in the petroleum industry, there are lots of other opportunities.
Yes, go back to Okinawa. Was when? When? What's the date?
Well, we arrived. We got on a troop ship. And this ship took 66 days to get to Okinawa. Trying to amuse yourself and keep from being assigned to chipping paint and that kind of stuff for 66 days is a real problem, but we succeeded in doing it. And we got to Okinawa, and the first place you go when you get there during a war is into a relocation camp, where you will then spend maybe 10 days to 2 weeks while they decide where to put you. Who needs people of this with these skills? And he got assigned to a fairly large ship. It was It was a repair ship for electronic servicing. So he was assigned to a ship which really utilized the skills that he had developed during our year of training. I got assigned to a small tanker because you got to have an electronic technician on a ship that has radar, because if the radar fails, why, your eyes are gone at night and mm-hmm. during any time that you need to be able to see what's going on and you can't see it visually, you need the radar. So I was assigned to a small tanker. And so we didn't see much of each other during the rest of the war, or during the time we were overseas. Actually, we arrived in Okinawa and spent about 2 weeks, and then were assigned, and we were both assigned to ships which were in Buckner Bay, which was the main staging point in Okinawa. There were about 100 other ships there who were gathering in order to invade Japan in mm-hmm. in September or October. And we were there 1 week, and during that time there was one time when there was a single Japanese plane flew over and was attacking. It was a kamikaze plane, and it actually dropped a bomb on a cruiser that was maybe 2 miles away from our ship. We, of course, every ship was at battle stations, and they were firing all the guns and all of that kind of stuff, and I was sitting in the communication center with the radios and the radar. This was over in a very short time because of the fact that the plane flew into the cruiser, and that was the end of the action. A few men were actually killed on that cruiser. That's the only action I saw during the war, because the following week the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and the war was over in days. So there was no more military action. And all that training was very good to have, and it would have been useful had the war dragged on, but there was really very little need for it, and certainly not the same kind of urgent need once the war was over. There was only one time when I really had to operate the radar. I was sort of both the radar operator and technician. I was not trained as a radar operator, but operating a radar, you turn it on and you look at the screen, and that's about it. And this is probably the best time, actually, to tell this story, because it was really quite an exciting thing that happened in September of 1945. A gigantic typhoon built up in the South Pacific and went right over Okinawa. And it was a major typhoon. It was a force 5 or whatever. They don't get any bigger. And the ships that were anchored there were still the flotilla that was going to be assembled for the invasion. And had the war not ended, that invasion would not have happened, because those ships were dragging their anchors. They were all crashing into each other in this lagoon, this big bay. And that would have set back that military action by quite a long time. So the captain on our ship had some experience in storms, and he decided that he'd be safer at taking his ship out of the harbor and going through the typhoon in the open sea than to stay in the harbor and be at risk of colliding with 100 other ships, many of which were a lot bigger than ours. And I think he was right, because a lot of them were seriously damaged. Mm. And it was a very bad place to be on shore, because pieces of corrugated metal from the Quonset huts were flying through the air and you know, just destroying everything. So he took the ship out, And as we went out the harbor, at the mouth of the harbor, I couldn't even figure out how he could find the mouth of the harbor with what was going on. But as we came out into the open sea, I didn't believe what I saw, because the waves were higher than the mast, and mm-hmm. mast on this ship was probably at least 100 feet high. So here are 100-foot waves, and the ship is going up the wave, over the top, starts down into this valley, which looks like it's very, very deep, and the prow just disappears under the next wave. And then it's shuddering away, and slowly it's trying to get out of that huge mass of water and get floating again and rising on the surface of the wave. And every time you did that, you wondered, you know, will this ship hold up under this kind of stress? Is it built that well? And it was a tanker. So, and it was had a full load of fuel. That was good in the sense that it gave it a lot of stability. It was set low in the water. It was bad in the sense that it increased the weight by quite a large amount. And as we went over the tops of the wave, here are the ends of the ship, the center is floating and the ends are just out in the air. And so the ship was flexing every time we went over these waves. After a while, maybe 3-4 hours, the flexing of the ship actually broke the hydraulic line from the steering wheel on the bridge to the steering engine room, where it actually activated the steering engine that moved the rudder on the ship. Fortunately, the designers of ships think about this, and they have a second wheel down in the steering engine room that is manned by a guy with earphones. And so if the hydraulic line breaks, then you read your compass and send compass bearings to the guy in the steering engine room. He can keep the ship headed into the waves, because if you get sideways, you broach and founder. But what we were worrying about was, if the flexing of the ship can break the hydraulic line, it could also break the electrical connection to the steering engine room, in which case there would be no way to keep that ship headed into the sea, and we would almost certainly all go down with it. So that was kind of a nerve-wracking situation, but what can you do except just keep going and doing what you're doing? So the captain had me sitting in front of the radar on a stool, and I had, because I get seasick, and there were no seasick remedies in those days, I was deathly sick, and so I had a bucket between my knees so that I couldn't leave the radar. And and I was thinking, what on earth good am I doing here at this radar? You know, when you have heavy seas, you get what's called sea return from the radar reflects off of these waves, and all you have is just a complete mass of heavy snow on the screen. A ship would not show up any better than these huge waves, and even if it did, what are you going to do? You don't really have any significant control. But the captain, you know, was by the book kind of captain, and, you know, when you're underway and can't see visually, you're supposed to have the radar on. So we had the radar on, and I sat there and threw up in the bucket. And at that time, that's when the ship rolled so much and pitched so much that in the little office space that I had, where I kept the textbooks that I brought along with me to study while I was overseas, some of them fell off on the floor, and a spare battery rolled over them and just more or less converted them into mush. And one of those was thermodynamics Lewis and Randall. And so after this was all over, I went out with my Lewis and Randall, and I dropped it over the edge and said a little prayer to it. And it's still there somewhere. There's some very educated fish over there. Anyway, this typhoon was really a monster, and these waves were huge. The winds got over 200 miles an hour before they blew away the anemometer on the top of the mast. And there were several other ships of destroyers, I think several destroyers actually foundered and sunk in that storm. And we were pretty worried that we were going to join them because of the problem of the chance that we couldn't steer the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Every time we went down below decks and tried to get some sleep, I remember you had to wind your arm around the chain that held the row of bunks together to keep from being rolled out of it. So I'd lie there and, you know, try to not pay any attention to the fact that the rivets were making popping sounds. And I would think, well, every time, you know, we go under one of these waves, this whole thing might just come apart. And this whole front, this whole prow of the ship might just fill with water. And I thought, well, that's a good quick way to go. And so no point thinking about this anymore. And that's really the attitude that came into my mind, is that I am absolutely powerless to do anything. I am at the mercy of whatever happens, and therefore I may as well not do anything except focus on what it is that I'm supposed to do. And it was interesting, because you don't know how you will respond to a situation. But that does help you to control fear.
Mm-hmm.
Is to realize it's not going to do you any good.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was quite an experience. We then went through the eye of the typhoon, and it's really true that the eye of the typhoon can be 10 or 20, maybe 50 miles in diameter in a really big one. The water is calm there, a little confused, but pretty calm. Ship was just sailing along very nicely and level. And off in the distance, there's these big black walls all the way around. You know, there's the storm out there. And up above, the blue sky. And then after you cross the eye, the wind comes up from the other direction, and it's just as strong as it was before. So altogether, we were in very heavy seas for nearly 3 days.
Oh, my gosh.
And then another day or so, just in very choppy water and trying to work our way back to Buckner Bay. So it was a very big impression that made on me as to the forces of nature. And now that, you know, I survived it, I'm very glad that I had that experience, because I would never really truly know the force that nature can really throw at you.
Mm.
Without actually having gone through it. So that was a major event in my life.
How when did you get out of the Navy?
Well, then following this typhoon, everything came back to normal out there, and they started sending home people by seniority. The ones who came out first had been out there longest, went back first, and so I knew I'd be out there for quite a while. And our little ship was assigned to a group of minesweepers to follow them around where they went and provide them with fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would take on a load of fuel, then we would go somewhere and sit in a bay, and they would go out and sweep mines, come back in and refuel, and when we were getting low, we'd go